said, well, what we can do is take a patient and we can double his white cell count in 8 hours if he's normal. Well, the normal doesn't get any benefits, so that's no basis for approval. So who's the guy that needs it? Well, he's the guy that's deficient in neutrophils. Well, what does it do for him? Well, if you take a look at his chemotherapy cycle, and if you give him GCSF at the very beginning of the cycle, he will not dip down as low in white cell count. He will still dip down, but he won't dip down as low for as long, and you've obviously given him a huge patient benefit, his white cell count. That's a biochemical constant. That doesn't constitute a patient benefit. Okay, well, what could be a patient benefit? You work with the FDA about that one, and they say, well, if he doesn't get infections, oh, I see, so if we can show that we treated the population the same, placebo and our guys, and they were comparable populations, then I got a lot of infections here and I didn't get it here. So we define these infections as febrile neutropenia. So you would get a fever from any source, but it usually was because of an infection. But we would count the number of febrile neutropenia patients that were on the drug and those that were not on the drug, and we'd compare. And the first study, which often happens, was surprisingly perfect. In other words, we had something like 30 patients, all of whom got febrile neutropenia, that had the controls, and we had 30 that are on the drug, and none of them got febrile neutropenia. We said, oh my God, this is too good to be true. It turned out to be nowhere near as good as that. It was like the ratios would ordinarily be 2-1, but they wouldn't be infinite. But that one was just one of those funny things that happens. It's a good thing when it happens early sometimes because it gives you tremendous momentum. It's a bad thing because you might be misled. But it always tracked that we reduced febrile neutropenia by a very significant percent, and the product was approved for that. But it's funny because people don't always realize the extra complications that they're involved here in doing the job and getting it through. But the stories, in some sense, there were parallels. It's like that, that you had to do an extra few steps to get through the FDA. They were both very fast. One was 3.5 years and one was 4.5 years in the FDA, which is astronomically fast. It's as fast as practically any AIDS drug has ever been. And they were extremely important products. As soon as they hit the market, they picked up sales right away. We sold $50 million worth of GCSF the first week.
Wow.
But we were different from our predecessor Genentech in the sense that what we did was I started warning people months in advance because Genentech took a terrible hit when they put TPA on the market and it wasn't an instant billion-dollar product. So what had happened was knew the history, studied it, understood it very well. They had promised a billion-dollar business, which they shouldn't have done, but they got trapped into it. Promised a billion-dollar business. They put the product on the market. They had pipeline filling the first week or so, which were computed out to being a billion-dollar business, and it looked like it validated, and their stock went soaring up, and then it started to go down. It just kept going down, and they lost about two-thirds of their market value when they were launching a successful product because the expectations had driven the price up much too high. So we avoided all that. I warned people that I didn't want them speculating about the company, and we will keep you informed, but we don't want you thinking that we're hiding something, that we got this product already approved, that it's already doing this, already doing that. So just wait till you hear the announcements and don't jump the gun too much. And we're probably going to report, if things go well, we'll report that we're on the market. We'll even report our sales, but be careful because those could be misleading. We could be pipeline filling. So we reported our $50 million in the first week, and it didn't blip our stock because we said, you have to understand this is pipeline filling, and no one would know. Is that $50 million going to last those patients, cancer centers, until the end of the year? It's going to last them a month. Well, it lasted about a month. And then we had to start renewing that, and it turned out that we didn't. That would have corresponded to a $600 million business. It wasn't that big, but it was a big business. It was about $270 or $300 million the first year, and it kept growing to a billion and so on. So, Amgen never underwent this surge, because we spent a lot of time convincing people they shouldn't let their euphoria take over and speculate about the company. And even with the $50 million in sales, we said, this pipeline, we're going to tell you we've had some pipeline sales. Well, how much were they? Well, they were $50 million in the first week, but we're filling the pipeline. We don't know how long it's going to last. And so that didn't drive the stock up, and it was a steady gain for quite a while. Amgen stock doubled every year for about 5 years or something like that, which is pretty twofold. That's a very nice uptick over a five-year period. So it was much steadier and better than some of the things that happened before. But We also benefited from the disappointment with the TPA. So people were ready to be cautious. I mean, they were. If TPA had gone through the roof, we couldn't have held it back. We'd have been the basis of speculation. So theirs goes through the roof, and we come second, and we're a disappointment. We wouldn't have been able to deal with that. But because they'd been a disappointment, we could work off of that. And so the two products had a lot in common, and then there were certain clear differences in both how they were discovered and how they affected the marketplace and how they were approved. But there were a lot of parallels too, and they were remarkably good. And I would have said, what would be my prediction would be that within 2 years Amgen would have another product, and it would be based on making platelets or something else in the hematopoietic family. But they also had a capability to do almost anything. It could be a cancer product, it could be any kind of a product. I figured we're just going to see enormous numbers of products very soon. And I didn't make projections to blow our stock price up, but if anybody asked me about the outlook for the biotech industry, I would have been more optimistic in those days than I am today, because I just thought you can hardly miss. Well, there are ways to miss, but I think that the promise of today is still wonderful, because the science has moved along a great deal, and there's plenty of opportunities. But you have this incredible psychological dimension in this business that, for reasons you can hardly understand, people get colder than ice, and then for reasons you can barely put together, they'll go higher than a kite. And there's certain common denominators to the euphorias and the pain. Euphorias come from when there's a reported very good scientific or medical result, and the pain comes when there's something negative like the pricing or something else. But there's still a lot of factors that you can hardly quantify that are very, very powerful effectors of our stock price and the attitude of at least the investment world, possibly the whole world, with respect to how good biotech is. So when Business Week says biotechnology, why it hasn't paid off, I said, that's a real indictment. You got all these people with their lives in your company, November or October 1994, and they're all committed to making biotech pay off, and the pronouncement is there, biotech, why it hasn't paid off. There are two images that I sometimes throw up, but I didn't today. I thought it would be too controversial. And one is a picture of Kerry Firestone saying in that issue, it hasn't lived up to expectations, so it just doesn't look very promising, phrase like that. And the other one is Lisa Tuckerman, also an analyst and investor, saying, the only solution would be if about 70% of these companies went out of business. And that was the recommendation for one of the experts in analyzing biotechnology companies. All we needed to do to solve our problem was that 70% of the companies go out of business. That's for me. Solve the problem for 70% of them, I guess. But it was those kinds of levels of pain are really quite remarkable. They you feel like you're really you've lost complete control of your destiny and the destiny of several hundred people that are betting on the company, and you're thinking, oh my God, how am I going to salvage this thing? But then you go into the lab and have somebody tell you what they've just done this week, and it's very exciting and very positive, and they've learned something you never would have dreamed of. They've got a way of causing radiation to desensitize. You've got a way of sensitizing cancer cells to radiation, and you're blowing them out of the water at levels of radiation that no one would ever imagine. And you say, holy cow, we can make something out of that. Well, it's cancer. We're not really in cancer. Well, we don't care. If it's based on something that we've discovered already, we'll push it as hard as we can. Or you find out that you're seeing some real progress in cutting down pancreatitis or some other disease state that you're beginning to realize is very serious and very, very, very difficult one to deal with. And you get all charged up again. Now these things all go up and down. The next piece of information can be the other way around. But it keeps things going. It keeps everybody in the organization going, that you have these areas of progress to offset some of these doldrums you get into just because of psychological reasons that we don't understand very well.
Yeah, that issue of, you know, these psychological and other sort of nebulous factors with these crazy cycles sort of is a nice segue into what I wanted to talk about next, which was about the importance of venture capital to the biotech industry, to a sort of tolerance of financial risk amongst American investors. Do you think that, and so let me try and start asking you about it this way. Do you think there's a difference between the tolerance of risk that venture capitalists in specific, their tolerance for risk, and then maybe Wall Street as represented by these analysts who make these prognostications, et cetera, et cetera? Or maybe that's not a well-form question.
Yeah, I think the venture capitalists understand the high-risk equation.
Right.
But they also have, their tolerance is very limited and prescribed. In other words, when we set up MGen, we wanted to raise $19 million or $15 million, and the question is, what would the venture capitalist expect as a payoff? He expected a tenfold return in 5 to 7 years. He knew he wouldn't get it from all these people, but he wanted you to put forth a plan as to whether you could get a tenfold return in 5 to 7 years. Then he could measure your plan against his plan against his plan, and he'll support the ones that have the most, the highest probability of giving that return. It turns out if you sustain a tenfold return over a 5 to 7-fold period, he only has to have one winner out of every three that he finances that do that. If you can sustain that same rate of growth, which is 42% compounded every year, for 10 years, he only has to have one winner out of 10. So he's not exactly risk tolerant, because he recognizes that 9 out of 10 of these are going to fail if he has one success. But and he's not very tolerant of the fact that you don't give him a promise of a tenfold return, he'll turn you down. So he's well aware of your risk,
right?
But if you can't offer him the reward, he won't have any part of it. So he's got this ability to manage a high risk situation as long as you can promise him a high return. The risk and return relationship for Wall Street isn't that equation. They're not trying to go to a customer and say, "How would you like to take risk your capital, but maybe quadruple it or tenfold?" The average investor doesn't want to be confronted with that purchase decision, because he's going to say, "Hell, I don't want to take a chance on losing at all. I want preservation of capital is one of the things I want." Wall Street's got to deal with investors that want preservation of capital, and therefore you just can't operate on that end of the risk equation. So you pass up the big rewards in many cases, because you're going to say, "I'm not going to take that kind of risk." So I'd say that, yes, venture capitalists are comfortable with risk, but they're just as demanding as Wall Street. They demand the return commensurate with the risk. Now, is a venture capitalist, did they play a critical role in the biotech development, biotech industry? Oh, my God, it's not even close. And the best way to see that is to take a look at the map of the United States and ask yourself where the academic centers are. Bam, 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 all over the country. They're in the Midwest, they're on the East Coast, they're on the West Coast. Then ask yourself where the biotech companies are. And those are all at academic centers. Bam, bam, bam. But they're not in the Midwest. The prevalence of biotech companies is on the West Coast and the East Coast. So you say, wait a minute. The secret for a biotech company is to be near an academic center. Why in the heck aren't they in the Midwest, where there's great academic centers in Wisconsin and Chicago and so on? What's going wrong here? Well, I presented stories to the venture capitalist community in the Midwest. The venture capitalist community in the Midwest makes a banker in California look like a risk taker. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous. They'll have a crowd there. They'll be talking to all these so-called aspiring entrepreneurs, and they'll give them the story as to how they can be an entrepreneur. You know how you become an entrepreneur? You put together your business plan. Now, be sure you have a good analysis of the cost of the product and what its market projections are year by year into the coming years. And when you've got that business plan with all your costs laid out and all the ifs and all the buts, then go get somebody who's running a company or the head of your school or somebody else to help you submit that plan to us, because we don't have time for just any old plan from anybody. Now, that's the Midwestern mentality. At least that's what it was about 1985. What's the mentality in California? The venture capitalist goes into the university, he says to the professor, "I just read your paper. That's a great paper. Would you like to be a millionaire?" Now, that's a hell of a difference from saying, "Put your plan together, have your costs worked out, and I'll get you a company, by God." And so, and he asked them in the Midwest discussion, it was, "How many of you like to be an entrepreneur?" "Oh, I just love it. I'd like to start a company." "Oh, I just love it. Yeah, oh boy. Well, here's how to do it." And then they tell them that, and they think, boy, they're all turned off. They'll never get anywhere. And they didn't. And there weren't any biotech companies to speak of. Even today, that are known that are in the Midwest. And yet, my God, Wisconsin has got a fabulous molecular biology department. And the University of Chicago and Illinois and Northwestern, well, they're all great. They've got great science. So, and it's absolutely essential to be near a science center. No question about that. You don't start a biotech company that comes down the middle of Kansas or somewhere. You don't do it. You just have to have those big academic centers. So venture capitalists are the difference. If you have risk capital there, you've got the fuel with the talented science, but you got to have the ignition as from the venture capitalists. And they are not in the game that involves Wall Street. Right. They play their shots very carefully. At the time when we started, the venture capitalists focused on startups. And the startup absolutely had to have a venture capitalist, or wasn't anybody else. No banker is going to finance them. So the venture capitalist was essential. But as time has evolved, a lot of them have become much more conservative. Not to the point of being like a typical Wall Street banker, but a lot of them will put their money into a small, publicly held company before they'll put it into a startup. And just look at the publicly held company and say, gee, you know, he went out on the market as a publicly held company at $8 a share, and now he's $1 a share. He's got to be a better bargain than this guy over here that can't possibly get public. First of all, when he's public, I've got an exit strategy. With this clown, I have a possibility that he's never going to get public, and I'm never going to get out. So I've learned my lesson about guys like you. I'm going to steer clear. I go with this guy, I'll buy his public stock, and I'll start looking at public companies a lot more than I ever had before, and that's true. So you have a funny situation. You have the real young startups that were never able to move into Wall Street right away, and now they're finding out they can't even move to venture capitalists. Hmm. And then they find out something even worse, and that is that if they struggle along with angel financing and other sources of money, that they still can't get into the public market, and practically like they're never going to get venture money one way or the other, because they can't enter the public market, because the public market's saying, we're waiting for companies that are further along than you are. We don't like this very primitive stage. So you're too primitive. You don't get enough money, you'll never stop being primitive, because you don't have enough money to really blow it out of there and get advanced clinical data or something else that you're going to apparently need to meet the requirements of going public. So it's been particularly in those periods in the last few years where, and we're certainly in one right now, where there's just not a great deal of unusual enthusiasm coming out of nowhere. There isn't that ability to finance a small company. Yet there are still financings of companies that are fairly prosperous. I have no doubt. Of course, we have a special situation. If we can get Bill to invest, we can finance any time in the world. But even companies that are not in our shape are able to finance much better than a very small company. As a matter of fact, they've set the number, and people looking at this have said, if you have a market cap of $500 million, you're really in trouble, because a lot of these institutions are not willing to come in and buy your stock because you haven't got a broad enough market base. Of course, we did a very funny thing. At ICOS, we went to the public market in the form of individual investors. So we didn't try to get institutions. And we were a one-year-old company, and we had 25,000 investors, and Amgen had about the same. So we were already very well spread over the retail market and very poorly represented in the institutional market. And everybody was very sad about that, except it turns out to be we were did it at a very good time, because the retail market was relatively stable and the institutional market was looking for bargains. And so when they suddenly think they can buy your stock as cheap as it's getting to be, they'll dump his stock and they buy your stock, and all of a sudden they all leave him, because a lot of them are momentum players, and they like to buy when the stock's going up. Well, that's a great thing. So you get this lovely surge when they all come in, and you go from 15% ownership to 40% ownership, and then one of them goes out, and your stock starts to go down. They say, gee, I bought the stock because it was going up. I didn't buy it because it was going down. Pooh, exit. And you go down to your 15% again, and in the process, you take one hell of a ride. So the financing of biotech is still very, very difficult. The venture capitalists have absolutely had a pivotal role. The academic institution, by the way, as I said today, absolutely a pivotal role. And Wall Street, in the form of a public market, has a pivotal role as well, because at the stage, if you're going to sustain the healthy balance of venture capitalists investing in early stage companies, they will not do it if there's no public market for these stocks. So it's just as important as ever been that you be able to hit the public market in a timely way and have, hopefully, solid progress in the public market. So what happened for a while was you could still get into the public market, but you squeeze so hard that within 2 or 3 months after you hit the public market, your stock was down. Companies like HighSeek, they'd come out of 10, go up to 20, and are down to 3, you know. Well, that's almost as bad as people not able to get in there. After a while, they say, I'm not going to take another risk on going into the public market with this kind of stuff because I see that it doesn't last. And I'm going to be selling the stock to my favorite customers, and they're going to be damn unhappy with me as if 3 months after I've sold them a nice big IPO that they're in love with, it's got one third the price of its offering. And so that makes it harder and harder to get public, makes it even less attractive for the venture capitalists then to go into the private realm where they have a wonderful mission, but where they aren't crazy, they don't have to give their money away. So it's but venture capitalists, the main message I want to be sure anybody gets is that I believe that it's a critical part of the success of this country in a lot of ways. The venture capital, risk capital system, broadly risk capital system, is what makes this company different and one hell of a lot better than any other company in the world. And the fact that people get rich and all the rest of this has made people, it's distressed people quite a lot. How much wealth do you want some guy working for Microsoft to have? Do you really want to have a billionaire on the street at Microsoft in Seattle? As far as I'm concerned, yes, you do. If that guy's working the way I know they're working, which is mighty hard and mighty fast and trying to do great things and very sensitive to what the world's looking for, as far as I'm concerned, that whole equation is a very good one. As far as I'm concerned also, I'm terribly biased, the technology, and this is why I like Chemical Heritage, that science and technology is what's made our civilization even more clearly in the past few years a prosperous civilization than ever before. And if people think that it's because we've got Clinton in there or because of something else is why we're prosperous, I feel that that's just terribly misleading. But the reason we're prosperous is we've allowed a system to continue to work that features high-tech, high-risk, and dynamic businesses that are rewarded if they are risk-takers that produce really good stuff. And so a lot of wealth has been created, and this has made a lot of things possible, including our present national debt and all the rest of this is all addressable by this power, and the power is so clear. I mean, these kinds of companies cannot form in Japan. They barely survive in Germany. In Japan, they can't survive because the big companies dominate everything in a kind of a coalition with the government. I mean, there's oversimplification. But in Germany, they can't survive in our business because they've got these very strong environmental groups that are just impacting the ability to do these things. So suddenly the U.S. is all by itself in the world markets for biotechnology products. And I think you got to give credit where credit is due, and some of it is a laissez-faire time in our government's actions with businesses, although not quite so laissez-faire with Microsoft as I'd like to see. But mostly we haven't had escalating tax structures, which is what kills a small effort. And we've also had the benefit of really literally letting technology move as fast as it can possibly move. That's been good, and the venture capital system has been effective. So, and the academic thing, I worry about it. The university bleeds on us about once a week by telling us, you know, that they're not getting as much out of the legislature. Can we help them? And we testify, and we write letters, and we say, for gosh sakes, why are you letting some of these tax control measures cut back on your support of the university? That's a kind of a terrible thing. And you should realize that when you adversely affect the university, you're affecting the economics of this whole community. And you're certainly affecting the ability to make companies like ICOS, because we wouldn't be there without the seeds from the university. Absolutely not possible. Okay.
All right. Well, I was interested to hear you talking earlier today, because I had these questions about venture capital that you, of course, mentioned. But another question that I had written down that you also talked about was intellectual property law and the patent system. And so I was glad to see that it's sort of on the right track. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the importance of that. Do you want to... What? Do you, if you could talk a little bit more about the importance of that change to being able to patent living organisms for just the growth of the biotech industry in general.
Well, it was viewed by the key point that it was caught right away by Bob Swanson as a key point for letting them go public. And why would that be? Because the power of biotechnology was to be able to duplicate a human protein in another organism. Well, think about it. If I duplicate a human protein in another organism, what do I patent? Can I patent the protein? Initially, you'd have to admit that it would be very unlikely I could patent the protein, because I'm duplicating a human protein. I didn't invent it. Nature invented it. So there's going to be a challenge there. It turns out there's ways to do it, but there's going to be a challenge getting conventional patents for the field of biotechnology. The conventional patent, if I invent a new chemical, is I get a patent on the chemical. I make this chemical and I can't get a patent because nature did it first. And I'll say there's a loophole that I can get through there, but it's clear that it was an enormous breakthrough to recognize the possibility and the reality that what I'm doing is something that is unique. I have created an organism. It's man-made. It's a living thing. But it does something that no organism has ever previously done. If I give business a right to that which it has created, it's not taking anything away from anybody. Now, Rifkin and other critics of biotechnology will say, it won't be long before companies will own every part of us. They'll own our genes. They'll own our proteins. They'll own every part of us. It's terrible. Appropriation by business of what really belongs to us as human beings. And it's a very appealing story, and it can scare the hell out of people. But the fact is that erythropoietin, as I mentioned, was named back in 1907. No patient had ever benefited from erythropoietin until we put the drug into patients in January of 1986. So you had 80 years that it was known by nature, but it wasn't doing anything for patients. The only time it was doing something for patients is after someone could make it by recombinant DNA. And had they created it, was it an invention? Well, Biogen couldn't do it and tried. And Genetics Institute couldn't do it, and Genentech couldn't do it, and Integrated Genetics couldn't do it, and Suntory and all of it. That's an invention. When everybody tries and they fail and you do it, that's an invention. So how are we going to protect this invention? Well, it turned out the Supreme Court decision was a perfect decision. We had cells that produced erythropoietin. We claim cells that produce erythropoietin. And we can claim them very broadly because no one had ever had any kind of a cell that they could tailor to produce high levels of erythropoietin. So that was a very natural thing for us. It was natural for Genentech when they had cells that would produce human growth hormone, and natural then when they had cells that could produce tissue vitamin and an activator, you claim the cells. Now you also have a chance of trying to claim the protein. And the basis for that is you have made the protein pure for the first time. Nature did not provide this protein to you in a pure form. It was therefore unsuitable for therapeutic use the way nature provided it. So you didn't invent the protein, but you invented pure protein. So you claim pure protein. And you could get that. But not always. Depends upon what's been known. If somebody had isolated some pure protein from natural sources, as Jean Goldwasser had done, that puts a crimp into that plan. Because he made tiny, infinitesimal quantities that are unsuitable for human testing. But he made it. So it was done. You can't say, I've invented it for the first time. And quantity is not an argument for invention. You either claim quantities if you want, but you can't claim the material itself. You have to claim something else. And it's pretty tricky to try to get around when you've already invented, when the nature has already invented and made, and then somebody has made pure stuff. Now, it just happens that the stuff that was made by Jean Goldwasser had been processed by the body, and it was therefore no longer fully active biologically. So what Amgen was finally, eventually able to claim was a fully active protein, more active than anything Jean Goldwasser had, and somewhat different in structure from what Jean Goldwasser had. So they were able to get a product claim. But without it, you could be right out in the cold. You have this patent that you've done wonderful things, and someone copies it. And in fact, that's what happened to us in Japan. They decided that they could copy our way of making these proteins, and because there was no patent issue, they went ahead and did it. And then, of course, they found out that, well, they finally did issue the patent in Japan after carefully looking at what the Japanese companies were doing, And the Japanese companies had decided by that time that you could make EPO from cDNA clones rather than genomic clones. And so they gerrymandered the patent that we were awarded to suggest it was limited to the genomic clones only, and so that the Japanese were ready to continue. They could continue to make the stuff with the cDNA, which was absolutely gerrymandered, there's no doubt about it. And the other thing is they didn't issue the claims on the gene until the companies had put their genes into organisms, so they didn't have to. They were no longer infringing the purified gene claims. So it's that's another way to do it. You claim the purified gene, because mm-hmm. nature never provided the purified gene to anybody. So that's a clear winner. But it's only good up to the time that they've put the purified genes into something, and once they've done that, then they're outside the scope of that claim.
Right.
So the patent system is very important. It's important that we've got the U.S. system was as enlightened as it was. I wasn't thinking about recombinant DNA in the summer of 80. I was just starting to think about it, but I sure wasn't aware of the enormous significance of that decision. Enormous for the United States biotech industry and for the world. And it's certainly clear that they made the right call, in my opinion. There's a whole industry, there's a huge amount of value that's been created, and the possibility of putting the kind of $500 million into a product, if the people can sit back and wait until you've done it and then say, you haven't anything to protect, I'll just move in like Searle did on the aspartame and I'll start making make the stuff. And I don't have to make everything you guys have made, because some of them fail in the clinic. So I can sit there and just make the winners if there's no patent protection, and I'm going to be best company around. So I think that intellectual property protection is a wonderful thing. And yet we had a judge who was looking at our case at one time and said, I'm going to make sure I do the thing that's in the public interest. I'm going to have as many suppliers of erythropoietin as I can possibly have. So he's really literally saying the patent system is a terrible system because it limits us to one supplier. And it's true, once you've made the discovery, it looks like it's in the public interest to force the person who made the discovery to license to everybody else. Because it looks like, well, now it's made, the best thing for the public would be to make it cheap for everybody by having everybody produce it. But the part of that equation that's faulty, and I feel very strongly, though it's hard to sell some people, is that without the inducement that I'm going to have control of this business, I will not make the $500 million investment to produce that product, and we'll wait for others to do it, and they won't be done, because I think they have to have some protection. Otherwise, it's foolish to spend the money in that way. Now you can do the next thing, and that is you can have the government step in and say, this is so important, we'll spend the money to make sure we make erythropoietin. Now you have the government in every element of our business that's important, because they're going to do it so much better because they have the money and nobody else does, because the free enterprise system has just failed. Well, the free enterprise system is not a bad system, and betting on it has never bothered me a lot, but there are people that keep thinking there's an improvement available in some way in which the government gets involved in a very deep way, and I'm opposed to it. But anyway, I think that the story on the patent side has been a good one. They speeded up the patent system. They got rid of Quigg, who was the patent commissioner at the time when Wyden got in the act, and nailed him in and drove him out. And the new people are very, very good. I've met with them, and they've made a bunch of very good calls. And now I'm not sure who the commissioner is right today, but I've dealt with the past commissioners, and they've been much better than they were there for a while. They were very smug, and Quigg was just thinking he was doing everything good enough. And patents were taking years and years and years and years, and it was very risky. So the only thing that has happened is sometimes in the gap in places like that,
mm-hmm.
we have been so imbued with worldwide vision and enthusiasm for worldwide coordination and cooperation that I think we just about sold the U.S. down the river once in a while. And the whole idea of going over from the one that we had, the system that we had, which was clearly to our advantage, which was 17 years from the date of issue to 20 years of the date of filing, and falling in line with the rest of the world in many things, was definitely not to the benefit of U.S. companies. Was it fair? Well, I think the new system is more fair in that sense, but there's a lot of compensating things that we do not do in this country that other countries do that are very punitive to trade and fair trade. And I didn't think that one place in which we had a slight advantage was something that we had to give away without any benefit. And that's what we did. We just gave it away. We just imbued with this idea we had to do the right thing by the world. And I'm sorry about that, because there was certain intrinsic advantages for us. And it was almost necessary, because you're still at the mercy of the other country when they decide not to issue the patent, for crying out loud. I mean, that's... What should we do? We should have lily white behavior on everything, and yet and treat every country with fair trade, even when they're being very unfair, and or let's say free trade. Maybe fair trade would be all right. If they're being unfair, then we become unfair. But trying to concentrate on free trade under all circumstances when it's not reciprocal is not very smart. We're a very powerful country, but we're not so powerful that you can give away every advantage and still come out economically ahead. So I think the patent system is one that has to take constant vigilance. And my own preference is to be concerned primarily about the developed countries. I feel it's kind of strange to concentrate on beating the crap out of Thailand or India or somebody that's a very undeveloped country and saying, they've got to issue those pharmaceutical patents because we want that market. We don't want them to be able to even serve their own market with a pharmaceutical that infringes our patents. And I guess that's true. We're entitled to the world market if we've done the work. If we're a pharmaceutical company, we're entitled to monopolize India and Thailand. But if you've covered the United States, Europe, and Japan, and they've had enlightened patent systems, and Japan's been improved but not enlightened, then at least Thailand isn't going to be importing in the United States. They're not going to be importing into Japan and Europe, because you knock them out at the borders. And so they use a nice development from the U.S. to help their own economies. I can't sweat that. I'm that much of a worldview that that's not the worst thing that ever happened. But I think it's terribly unfair when they start cutting into the markets that are viable for us and where we should have the kind of patent protection that would make it exclusively our market. That's unfortunate. So anyway, there's a lot that has been accomplished, and lobbying was a factor there, and congressional oversight was a factor in making it work right.
You pause that.
Yeah. It will track us down if they get very anxious, and I'll put the call in to my son when the time comes.
Okay. Do you want to tell us a little about the transition between Amgen and ICOS, and how? You
What part are you interested in?
Why? How? Okay. Feelings about it.
What actually happened was there was really no relationship between what I did at Amgen in resigning as CEO and ICOS. I'd never heard of ICOS when I resigned as CEO and retained the chairmanship. And that was simply a matter of feeling that it was appropriate at my age, which is a lot less than it is now, but at my age, that there were people there that were capable of running the company. We were about to launch erythropoietin. I figured that would be a great thing if they got a running start by launching erythropoietin as the new management team. And I was worried that I was getting too old to really carry the burden of a company of that size and magnitude. And felt there were lots of good reasons like that I should face up to the fact that I should no longer stay as CEO. I presented that to the board. The board said, well, they don't like that idea. But they said, what do you propose to do? And I said, well, I propose that Gordon Binder become CEO, Harry Hickson become chairman. ICOS is not even close to being around. It has never been thought of. There's no such thing. Some people say, why did I do this? It had nothing to do with ICOS. It was just a matter of saying I reached that stage where that probably was a good thing to do. And I knew that these two people were very eager to have that responsibility, and I knew that would be great, and it did. They didn't like each other very much, unfortunately, and I worried about that, but I knew they'd work together, and I told them they had to work together because I'm still around and I'm a heavy stockholder, so they better figure out how to resolve their differences. And they did a great job. So they launched the product 6 months later, in the summer of 1989, as you saw. And late that year, ICOS was formed by two venture capitalists and Bob Nowinski, and they approached me right away and said, would I like to be chairman of the board? Well, I was still chairman of the board of Amgen, and it certainly was an acceptable idea to me that I be chairman of the board of a couple of companies. I didn't think the chairman of the board had to be a full-time job, though I was a full-time chairman when I was at Amgen. So I talked to Amgen about being chairman of the board of ICOS, and I said, yeah, it's kind of a tempting board. I thought it would be a lot of fun with Walter Wriston and Frank Carey and the rest of this. And it's kind of a nice, interesting new company, and I would like to do that. And I'll stay on as chairman of Amgen as long as it's appropriate. So I thought I'd probably stay as chairman of both companies, though I was already toying with the idea that I might move to Seattle and be chairman of both companies from Seattle rather than from Thousand Oaks, because I really didn't have that big a job in Thousand Oaks. The better they did as the CEO and the president I put in, the less job I really would have. So I thought, but I'd still enjoy being chairman. So they approached me to join ICOS as chairman, and I said, okay, that I'll check it out with Amgen. They had no concerns. And so I joined and became the chairman as of about the 1st of February, 1990. And the object of ICOS then was to raise some money and then start a lab, and we already had pre-recruited these 65 people. I was in the process of doing that, and I visited with a scientist. I got charmed all over again with the starting point. And I have to say, in many ways, it was more interesting to me, and I felt more vital as a member of a brand new group getting started, and they hung on every word I said. I was worrisome. I thought, I can't help them as much as they think I'm going to help them. But I knew I could play a very pivotal role because I'd been there. You know, I can help them get to Mars. I've been to Mars, so that ought to work. And I was seeing some changes in Amgen, which were very difficult for me to get excited about, namely the new building that's going to have more floors and have more offices and be bigger and more expenditure than ever before. And I just kind of shied away from these kind of, for me, when I go through the buildings at Amgen, people ask me, they say, how do you have the courage to take the risk of starting the company from scratch? And I say, it takes a lot less courage for me than authorizing a building like this that has, you know, it's got, you can hardly see to the end of the building, you've got inlaid in the desks, you've got money being spent in every possible direction. I think those are really hard decisions for me, but starting a company, that's pretty easy. And I really feel that way. So I had to say my comfort level, as soon as I started dealing with the scientists at ICOS, was all over on that side. That's fun. They're just getting started. They need help. We were redundant in many ways back in Amgen. But I really did intend to stay on both boards. We then had a financing, and that financing was one of those rather stimulating experiences, because as we went around the country, the founders of ICOS had decided that's why they wanted me to help the financing. I didn't realize that, but that was true. And so the deal would be that we'd go to the Payne-Weber system that had been used by Amgen and go to their sophisticated investors, Reed Rich. And the rich investors would probably buy the stock because they had a good association with me, because the Amgen investment had paid off so famously. And it worked exactly according to the scenario. These guys are smart guys, you know, probably smarter than I was, so I just went along with this. Going up and down in the streets of the U.S. and talking about buying the stock of ICOS, and it went like hotcakes. So we thought we'd raise $25 million, which was an awful lot. It was more than Amgen had raised. And instead we raised $33 million, and Bill Gates came in for $5 million. So we raised $28 million in the regular market and $5 million from Bill. And it was a smashing success. And when it was over, and I knew that there was a key role being played, because I'd get to these meetings and people come up to me and say, oh, you've made my whole family is indebted to you. I said, it's not me. It's Amgen. It was a great company. And they say, oh, we'd buy anything that you're associated with. And then they bought ICOS. So I suddenly realized that this had a downside, which was that very shortly the people would come back to the Payne-Weber brokers and say, well, is Rathman going to stay with Amgen? And they come to me and say, are you going to stay as chairman of Amgen? And I said, we're just looking at the transition there between Amgen and ICOS. I said, well, yeah, I'm going to stay as chairman of Amgen. Oh, well, that's really a disappointment for the entire Payne-Weber organization. Why is that? Well, we went out and sold the idea of ICOS stock because you're chairman. I said, well, yeah, I'm chairman. They said, well, but now people are asking us, if you're still chairman of Amgen, how much time are you really going to spend at ICOS? I said, I'm going to spend more time at ICOS because that's where I'm needed. Amgen's got a management staff. Well, that's not acceptable. We're really having troubles. People are really very cynical. They've heard that you're going to stay on as chairman of Amgen. I said, well, I don't know what to do about that. I'll go talk to Amgen, but I told Amgen that I'd stay on as chairman. And I went there, and then I talked to the board, and the board said, George, you said you're going to stay on as chairman. I said, yeah, I know I said that. I said, but please, I really think I have to resign. I'll stay on the board, but I have to resign. Okay, you want to...